Welcome, friends, episode 62 of the Book Exchange Podcast. It's great to have you on for another new episode. We welcome our listeners from around the world, and this is your favorite podcast where twin Virgils take you on a ride through the literary landscape, and it's the only one where that will happen for you, so spread the word. My name's Jude. I'm out here in the Lehigh Valley in Pennsylvania, and right now I'm going to give a warm welcome to my twin brother and co-founder of the Book Exchange Podcast, John, in Easton, Maryland. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. And so I will wish you a belated happy Thanksgiving, which is, you know, a holiday in America anyway. I don't know if it is anywhere else. Probably not. But it's an American tradition. So we just celebrate, you know, families get together and feast and visit and all that good stuff. So I hope. Well, we were together on Thanksgiving Day for most of it, so I know you had a pretty good Thanksgiving, but I hope the rest of the weekend has been good for you, and it's been a good weekend for all of our listeners.
Yeah, thank you. Happy Thanksgiving to you, and we're definitely thankful for all our listeners around the world, whether you have Thanksgiving in your country or not. I'm getting over some illness. I've had a real bad cold, and I've still got a killer sore throat. So I might cough, I might scratch a little bit. But the rest of the weekend is pretty mellow here. I happen to have a daughter who's turning 18 tomorrow. So just shout out to my daughter, Jane. Happy birthday, honey.
Happy birthday, Jane.
I don't think she listens much. But anyway, yeah, thank you. It's been a good weekend. Hopefully yours is too. And I want to remind people, I do this all the time, John, but I'll just say, frankly, you know, we don't hear from people a lot. But there is an avenue for you to do so if you want to get in touch with us by email. Book Exchange Twins, exchange with the next, bookexchangetwins@gmail.com. I bring it up because I never know if somebody's going to hear this who wants to get in touch with us. And I just encourage people, if you do want to comment on the show or make suggestions or anything, if you want to reach us by that email address, we do check it. And when we do get an email, we'll say something about it, you know, unless it's a crank note or something. We'll say something about it on the air. So get in touch with us if you want to.
Also, I'll just jump in, and every podcast that ever existed says this, but it takes about 2 seconds to give a rating on Apple or Spotify, or, you know, whether it's stars or numbers or whatever, or thumbs up or thumbs down. If you're listening to this show, or if you just even hear one episode and you like what you hear, please give us a positive rating. Because that does help the show. And thank you.
Good point. Yeah, please do that if you feel so inclined. But other than that, John, do you have any other preliminaries or anything you want to say about the last two-part Stephen King episode or anything like that?
The only thing I'm going to say is that we pledge right now to make this only a one-part episode. We're not going to do a two-parter across 2 weeks. So I don't know whether that's a good thing or not for our listeners, but we're going to try to fit this all into one episode here. But no, there's other than that, I don't have any preliminaries. There's a lot to discuss with this particular book, which we haven't even announced yet, but we're going to get to that momentarily. So no, I say we just move forward.
Okay, then we'll do that. We're going to follow our standard template here. But just for the record, John just brought it up. This is episode 62. Like I said, this is a BXC Reviews episode, Book Exchange Reviews episode. That's one of our occasional series where we take a single book, teased it last time, and we both read it, and then we both kind of jump into it. This is kind of what I like to think of as a purist BXC Reviews episode, where we take a book that's not familiar to either one of us. Sometimes we try to pick something that's a little buzzy, if you'll forgive the term, and dive into it and see what we make of it as two kind of old timers, you know, who are very interested in books and literature. And then we toss it around. That's what this is today. The name of the novel we chose is called The Rabbit Hutch. It is a debut novel from a young woman, American writer named Tess Gunty. And it happens to be set in the area she comes from, which is Indiana in the Midwest of the United States. Debut novel that somehow tapped into the zeitgeist, John, and wrote it all the way to the National Book Award, which she won this past November, last year. November 2022, she won the National Book Award.
Oh, I actually didn't even know that. I knew it was nominated. I did not know that she won it for this book. That's interesting.
Yeah, she did. She won. She beat out some pretty stiff competition. And so anyway, and I think it got a minor of a bevy of other smaller awards, but it was very successful. We're going to talk about why not we think it was successful. So that's our episode for today. We both read the book, and we're going to unpack it. And just a little, you know, disclaimer here. You know, if you're interested in the book and haven't read it, you might want to table this episode until you have read it and come back and listen to it, because we're going to really unpack it. And if you're not familiar with the Rabbit Hutch and don't mind spoilers, then just stay where you're at and stay tuned. So with that, we're going to follow our standard format, though, in which we first take a few minutes to discuss the books that we're reading right now and what we think about them. So, John, here comes the pass. What are you reading right now, and what's it all about?
Well, it's a completed reception, first of all. I caught the pass without any problem. Nice throw.
Nice. Yeah.
So after, you know, I picked up the Rabbit Hutch for this episode, I kind of blew through it, I must say. It was I did not find it hard to read, and it kept me engaged, but more on that later, as we like to say. So after the novel, listeners to this show will recognize, I like to vacillate between fiction and nonfiction. I don't always do it, depending on what we're preparing for the podcast or whatever my mood strikes me. But this time I wanted to, I don't know why, but every once in a while I wanted to challenge myself to read something a little bit that required some more mental effort, which is not to say that the Rabbit Hutch didn't, because there was tons in the Rabbit Hutch that, you know, I chewed on and mulled over quite a bit. But so for whatever reason, I switched over to nonfiction, and I picked up a book that's been on my shelf for a little while. It's called Real Presences. It's written by a philosopher who is now deceased, but only recently, in the last 10 years, I think he's passed away. So he's grappling with some ideas that are certainly contemporary ones, I guess you would say. It's a difficult book to read, and it's a difficult book to describe. But I'll just say, even though his training is in philosophy, he also teaches comparative literature. And if this book is any indication, you know, he butts up against or bleeds into theology quite a bit. So this book is called Real Presences, and it's basically, I guess I would just say that it's a book-length essay or argument that posits the claim that any type of creative endeavor, any type of creative act, whether it's writing a novel, writing a poem, writing a song, painting a painting, crafting a sculpture or whatnot, is sort of inherently an argument for the existence of God. So that's sort of what the book argues in a nutshell, but it does so in a very kind of complex and comprehensive way. So he's going back a lot into the history of ideas. There's quite an element of, I'm forgetting the word, you know, the study of words. You know, he's a lot about language. It's a lot about man being the talking animal. So he's building this case for why any type of creative act is sort of in itself an argument for the existence of God. So that's a subject that I thought would be really interesting to think about. And I'm only about halfway through the book. It's very heavy sledding. He's very academic, although I will say, Jude, in passing, but his writing is at times like kind of stops you in your tracks. He's like actually a really poetic writer. There's some points he makes that, you know, I'm struggling to grasp it, but I can tell that it's beautifully put. So I guess, you know, I'm working my way through the book. It's hard work, but I do find it rewarding. And I guess that's all I can say, because I'm still trying to figure out what the argument is, and, you know, sort of see what I can get from it. But, you know, I enjoy this kind of challenge. And I certainly care a lot about creativity and art and thinking about God and the divine. So that's what I've been doing. Good luck following that one up. And
but, yeah, especially with what you know I've been reading. So
yeah, but you know, like I said to you, like I'm way out in the Atlantic and the water is very choppy, and I'm just trying to keep my head above water right now. But I am enjoying the swim. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, that's really interesting, John. That topic and that subject of that book, when you told me about it, resonates with me quite a bit. You know, I could talk for a while just about this, but like, you know, first of all, it strikes me that, you know, this is a book that you're interested in. This kind of book is definitely one that you're interested in. And, you know, I know how this sounds, but, you know, because I think you're as creative a mind as anyone else's mind, but you're not necessarily a creative artist. Like, you know, like your son's a musician and your twin brother's a writer, right. Although you are a writer, but you're not, you know, engaged every day, I guess, in creating something new in a way.
Right. No, you're right. Definitely.
But I think you're, you know, this topic would definitely, I can see why it would interest you just because of my knowledge of you, but also, you know, that whole premise about, you know, the creative process, you know, being some kind of proof for the existence of God resonates with me quite a bit, but I also can see why you would be interested in it. I think it helps you to, you know, I was saying to you off the show that you have even though you don't create music and books, you have a very sharp critical faculty, I think, more so than me. And, you know, we could argue.
I don't know about that. Yeah.
That's just my opinion.
Thank you.
But, and I think this kind of book, you're obviously very interested in it, but it also really helps to sharpen that skill that you have. And, you know, you've returned to books like this regularly throughout your reading. This is also where you kind of most closely resemble kind of like the mental footprint left behind by our dad, which we talked about before.
Yeah.
You know, this is a kind of thing that sort of in the wheelhouse of what my dad would kind of consume as like an afternoon snack, you know, our dad. But
right. It's like, you know, like we're all in a way, unless you didn't grow up with your dad or something, you know, like we're trying to catch up with the giants who came before us, you know?
That's right. Yeah, that's right. This is where your reading practice is where you remind me of him. Let's put it that way. And also, just real quick, you know, because I am engaged in my case, like, you know, creative writing. And as we've said a few times, I'm trying to like close on the finish line of this novel I've been writing all year. And, you know, the topic resonates with me, but I've always felt that, you know, one of my favorite verses from the Bible, and I promise this won't be as long as it sounds like it's going to be. One of my favorite verses of the Bible, as you know, is like the second verse of the Bible or very early in Genesis, where it talks about the Spirit of God moving over the darkness, over the waters.
Right.
That profoundly resonates with me because I honestly believe that when we create music like your son or a drawing or a poem that you have done for years in the past, or you're writing a novel like me, you're mimicking that mystery. You know, first of all, I absolutely adore that image of the Spirit of God moving over the water. But I also think you're trying to mimic what God did at the beginning of time. You know,
right?
And I really believe that, and I think that speaks to the same idea that's in your book, the book you're reading. So, like, you know, great choice. And I just wanted to say that.
Well, I hate to say this, Jude, but like in the thought that you just expressed, which I think is a really fascinating one, you adhere very, very, very closely to a good friend of yours, Mr. Nick Cave, who's expressed, he has expressed something very strikingly similar to that. And it was something that I just heard recently on his expression of an idea that was really, really close to what you just said. So I'm sorry because, you know, just for our listeners' benefit, Jude is not a fan of Nick Cave or his music, and I am. So we like to rag on each other about that.
Needle each other, yeah.
But he recently very profoundly, I thought, expressed an idea that's very, very close to what you just said. So I'm sorry, but you guys seem to agree on at least a few points. But anyway,
well, you know.
Anyway, we need to move on to what you've been reading lately, so go ahead.
Well, points from Nick Cave. I'll give him points for that. But yeah, actually, there's kind of a little bit of a connectivity between, believe it or not, between the book you're reading and the book I'm reading. But I have been dying to read the book I'm currently two-thirds of the way through for as long as it's been known to exist. I think it was announced sometime around last spring, and it is the autobiography of Mr. Geddy Lee, who is the lead singer and bass player for and keyboard player from Rush, my favorite rock band in the world, Rush. The one band that I've returned to every decade in 10 cycles since I was 13 years old. And since we just turned 53, that's like an even 40 years. His memoir just came out. You know, Rush famously played their last show in 2015. Their great, great, great drummer, Neil Peart, died of brain cancer in 2020. And so now here we are in 2023, and Geddy Lee has published his memoir all about Rush and his life. And I'm two-thirds of the way through it. I really don't want to say a lot about it because I know that John is going to read it. But I guess I'll just say this, which I haven't said before. I was afraid that I was not going to like it. At least part of my brain had a fear of that. But for my money, this book is, you know, I'm a huge fan, but it's a very fascinating book. And it's fortunately bears some of Geddy Lee's hallmarks in interviews and whatnot. He's a very articulate and sharp person. He's a thoughtful person. He has a quirky sense of humor, which sometimes rears its ugly head in this book. There's a lot of revelations, things I had no idea that took place behind the scenes with Rush. But mainly, I think he's very, and this is where I said you can make a segue, he's very candid and articulate about not only his music, but his creative process. And even, believe it or not, there's ample time where he talks about his, he's kind of well known to be an atheist and a non-believer. And he explains very candidly, and I think very reasonably, why he feels that way in this book. So a man like Geddy Lee, who I think is a creative, who I think of as a tremendous creative influence, an innovator and a constant, like constantly has tried to improve his art all along in his entire career, would not attribute any of that to, you know, lending an argument to God's existence. And he's very clear about that in the book. And he's very candid while kind of being respectful of others at the same time. So that's just an interesting thing. You know, there, here's a very, another very important creative influence, at least on me, who doesn't believe that it has anything to do with the creative energy or the creative capital C God that you and I believe in. So, but I love the book. It is fascinating. If you're a Rush fan, you cannot miss it. So go read it.
Yeah, that is quite interesting. And anybody who's ever seen, you know, an interview that's more than a minute or a minute and a half long with Geddy Lee kind of knows how thoughtful and, you know, careful with in his choice of words even that he can be. And one of the most fascinating things about him, by the way, is that he seems to have outside of, like, obviously Rush is no more, but, you know, Rush is, they're kind of a band people love or hate, and there's not much middle ground. But worldwide, they're just unbelievably popular. So, I mean, they have this global audience that continues to this day. And it's a huge, just like any band like U2 or like Springsteen or like, you know, any of these bands, Coldplay maybe, you know, the community, for lack of a better word, around them is enormous. I mean, it's like an ongoing. But Geddy Lee seems to have little to no interest outside of being on stage or recording with Rush in being in Rush in a way. Like, and what I mean is obviously he loves music and creativity, but like he's talked about his life outside of the music. And it's just like, it sounds like no matter what he does, he just wants to be as far away from Rush as possible, you know, which I think is really interesting. You know, like it's almost like a massive act of compartmentalization, you know, like Rush is a huge compartment. Can you still hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Rush is a huge compartment, but then his life, he seems to have a very, you know, a rich life outside of that has nothing to do with Rush, which I think is pretty interesting.
Yes. Yes. And yeah, I could go on all day about Geddy Lee and Rush, but it's a really fascinating book. I'm just loving it so much. It's one of these books I'm going to be sad that I'm done with. You know,
that's great. So, that's great to hear as someone who's definitely going to read it, and a huge Rush fan as well. But you know, it's worth noting, of course, too, as we've said on this show before, but in this context, that you're someone who's actually written a book about Rush. So this is not is not just a experimental foray for you. This is something that you've been interested in for a long time.
Yeah, true. And that's actually one of my favorite books. One of my favorite of my own books is the book I wrote about Rush. You know, I really had a good time writing that book.
That's a really fun book. Sorry to cut you off. That's a really fun book. So anybody who's even remotely interested in Rush, go seek it out on Amazon. It's called Random Samples. But anyway, I think that brings us to the end of this segment, does it not?
It does. And I don't have any further administrative notes. So are you ready to dive into the discussion of the rabbit hutch?
I'm ready, man.
All right. So, John, I have the way we're going to do this is, you know, because you relied heavily on my expertise, in air quotes, on Stephen King in our last two episodes. So I'm just going to – I'm not calling you an expert on Tess Gunty or the Rabbit Hutch, but I'm going to be lobbing the questions at you this time is what I'm getting at. So as we said in the beginning, John, this is a novel we didn't really know. It caught onto the zeitgeist somehow. It's a debut. It blew up. It won a major American award. So I want to ask you right off the bat, just in general terms, don't get into the weeds on this yet, but do you think, you know, and don't think about it too hard, do you think, John, that this book was worthy of all the love it got in the literary world?
Yeah, I thought that might be where you're going. Tough question.
And we're going to have to, forgive me for interrupting, we're going to have to start getting into the plot elements in order to answer that, but I'm looking for kind of your gut thought on this.
Right. It's a tough question, and you're tempted to answer it kind of. It's one of these things where it's like the way you should answer it versus like how you personally feel about it. I'm going to go on the side of myself personally, because I think that's what we're bringing to this discussion.
Yeah.
And I'm going to hedge a little bit. I can totally see why it, you know, has resonated with people at this moment in time, why it tapped into the zeitgeist, or however you want to say it. And, you know, I think that has a lot to do, without being an expert on these awards, I think that has a lot to do with, you know, why certain books are chosen for these things, you know?
Yeah.
I think, and that has to do with A, the people who are making the selection, but B, also, you know, the way certain books may comment on, you know, contemporary issues or, you know, things that are relevant to people right now. So this book, I totally get that, why it might be awarded such a prestigious award on that basis. I think the book shows a ton of talent. I think the book is a little bit messy, but I, you know, a lot of times, and by that I just mean it's sort of like, you know, she's a young writer, so she's, and this is kind of her big project coming out of graduate school and the MFA program and all that. So I think there's a tendency for young writers to just kind of throw everything in but the kitchen sink, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Unruly?
And, what's that?
Unruly?
Unruly. Sort of. I mean, I think it's not that I think the book is pretty coherent. And it has a very clear kind of beginning and ending. It's well constructed. But, it, you know, there it's kind of bursting with ideas that, you know, if you listen to any interviews with her or read any, you can sort of see where, you know, you can do the connective work to kind of see where those ideas may come from with her own experience. I think it's tough. I think it's worth recognition, you know, whether it should be the National Book Award winner. I think that feels a little bit like, oh gosh, like a stretch a little bit to mm-hmm. me, because I think the book does have some flaws. I don't know what it was up against, but I think there's more that goes into these decisions than simply literary merit. Like I just said before, you know, there's politics and there's sort of like,
you know, what's trending and whatnot, which I think she would chuckle about because there's a lot in this book about social media and, you know, she's pretty critical of it in places. But so I think it's worth recognition. I'm not sure that I personally think it's that great, but I think it's a pretty impressive debut. I guess I'll say that. All right. So rather than give my answer to that question, I plan on kind of ringing in on other questions that I'm going to ask you. But I was wondering if you could take a quick run at the plot, like explaining, you know, in a few sentences what this book is about so our listeners know if they're, you know, they're listening and they haven't read it or are interested. And that is to set up my second question that I want to ask you, which is really going to kick off the discussion here. So could you take a run at just explaining what this book is about in a high, you know, one paragraph or a high level?
Sure. I'll give it a shot. And I'm sorry, I have a bit of a frog in the throat, so I apologize for that.
Me too.
So this is a book about a small city or town or large town, however you want to say it, in middle America. Tess Gunty grew up in South Bend, Indiana, and it's kind of basically modeled after a place like that. And it looks at sort of life in this decaying city, you know, sort of post-industrial middle American city, which is way well past its heyday. So, you know, it was kind of developed and became the community that it was because of the automobile industry. There's a fictional automobile company that had kind of like, that's where the money in the town came from. And that's what sort of drew everybody there. But over time, you know, that work and that industry in the town has faded away. And so like with a lot of middle American cities, you're kind of left with a crumbling shell of a city and community that once was. And so that's kind of the meta stories that here's a city and community that's sort of trying to figure out how to revive itself and how to continue into the 21st century. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the background, and what she does in order to explore that, she the title of the book, The Rabbit Hutch, is a nickname for a community of apartments, an apartment building that's kind of like a bit of a high rise, or it might be a series of high rises, and it has a fancy French name, but the name translates to like basically rabbit hutch. I'm not going to attempt the French, but so she's telling the story, like she's telling the story of this town in a polyphonic manner, which is a fancy word. It's just multiple voices. And there are various characters in the apartment complex that, and their stories are what she sort of weaves together. And so you focus on three or four or five different characters and their life stories that kind of, you know, helix together. And in so doing, she kind of tells the story of this town and what's going on in this town. And she focuses in particular on a young woman who we come to know as Blandine, but a little bit of a spoiler alert. You know, there's another storyline that involves a younger woman that you realize is the same woman as Blandine. So she's sort of, you know, you get kind of two, they're weaving storylines that aren't just different characters, but they're also different time frames. So the novel is constructed with, you know, some of the chapters are, might be in the form of a news report. Some might be, you know, epistolary, you know, what's that word? Like in the form
epistolary.
Of epistolary. Thank you. In the form of letters. There's a chapter that's all just graphic images. So she's playing with different ways to tell the story too. But,
yes,
it's really kind of a story about this decaying city and what's happening there. And, well, I guess I'll leave it there because there's different things going on with other characters, but I feel like we're going to get into that. So I don't know how I did. I would give myself maybe a C+ or B- for that description. What do you think?
No, I think I'd give it a higher grade than that. There's one thing that I think you left out, which I think is important, which is that Blandine lives in the rabbit hutch with three other people. They're all young men, and all of them are products of the foster care system in the United States that they've aged out of. So when they age out, you got to go find a place to be. And so they were all in the same system. They decide to live together in this rabbit hutch. So that's kind of integral to the main character, Blandine's background, as well as the three guys that are sort of sub-characters. But other than that, I think you set it up nicely, especially weaving in some of the elements of where it is, which is set in Indiana, like where Tess Gunty came from. And it's sort of modeled vaguely after South Bend, because South Bend had a Studebaker plant in the city that kind of went under. So this fictional automobile company called Zorn Automobiles is a kind of a, you know, standing in for that. But other than that, I think you kind of covered it. It's this conglomeration of stories around people that live in this rabbit hutch. And Blandine is kind of the lead character, but there are other people. You still hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. There are other people that live in the rabbit hutch that, and their lives are talked about. And then there are a couple characters that are kind of like, what do I want? Like ancillary to the rabbit hutch or ancillary to the city in Indiana, but they kind of weave in there in ways that are explored in the novel. And the other thing is that the name of the city in the novel is called Vacca Vale.
Yeah.
V-A-C-C-A. I don't know. For some reason, that name bugged me a lot in this book. I thought it's fictional. It's obviously fictional. I thought it sounded vaguely pretentious, but I think that's just a reaction on my part. It's not really fair.
You know, it is sort of a strange choice. I thought about it myself. I found myself wondering, like, why she picked that name, but who knows?
Yeah, it grated on me a little, but I don't think that's very fair to Tess Gunty. I think it was just kind of this little reflex I had. But anyway, John, and I promise I'll be more of a participant. I mean, I got plenty I can say about it. But the reason why I had you kind of a description of the book is I'm going to throw you another, you know, curveball. Not really a curveball, but I do want you to kind of answer it again, just not giving it too much thought. But I'm sure you were thinking about it as you were reading it. It's another kind of hard one. But then I'll ring in and we'll go from there. What do you think this book, and you kind of alluded to it, I very much agree with you that it's like this pastiche. It's kind of like it does bear the hallmarks of an early novel. It does kind of feel like everything was tossed in, you know, that she was thinking of or that was going on in her life or in her mind. And it does feel like this book that kind of went through a couple MFA programs and, you know, this novelist read it and gave her some suggestions and these people read it in a workshop and gave her some suggestions. It's kind of like sprawling thing that was around for a long time. And I sense that about this book very much. But what I want to know is what do you think this book is really about, John? Like, I wrote down a couple of suggestions. You may have some of your own. Like, I know it's got a little bit of this and that, and I was trying to think of, like, what is this book really taking on? Do you feel like, for example, is it really about, because there's a whole spiritual quotient to the book, and spirituality is obviously of some interest to Tess Gunty. Do you think this book is kind of like about spiritual malaise in the world or in young people or in America? Do you think it's more about this portrait of a dying America, like with its economy and, you know, the American dream and, like, you know, what the country once used to be is now crumbling? Or another thought I had about this book was, do you feel like it maybe has more to do with, like, love? I had a thought at several points in the book that almost a lot of the characters really seem to be just looking for connection or love, for lack of a better term.
Right.
All the foster care products, those four young people. There's one guy in the book who's had this horrible relationship with his mother, who was a celebrity, an actress. And he was abandoned by her, and most of his actions are a reflection of his bitterness over being abandoned. There's one woman who has trouble connecting with her baby, her newborn, and she can't find in her the love that she feels like she's supposed to have, which I thought was interesting. I know Tess Gunty does not have any children. She's a young woman. She doesn't have any children. Thought it was interesting that she took that on in the character. But what does your gut tell you? Like, what do you think the book is mainly about? another hard one, but
no, I have plenty of thoughts around that. And it's interesting because I wrote down several things that are sort of related to that question. Mm-hmm. But what you just said, that reading about the book really being about love, was not one of them. And I think that's a really interesting reading. And I think we'll get back to that, but I think that could be a very valid way of looking at this book. It actually kind of explains a couple questions that I had about the book. You know, if what you're saying is right, then some of my questions maybe make a little more sense. So that's really interesting. We'll get back to that. So I did cheat a little bit, quote unquote cheat. You know, like I told you that I heard one interview with her. That was about 45 minutes where she was talking about the book. And I just thought it would help me kind of understand, because there was a lot I admired in this book, and there was a lot that I was just, you know, sort of questioned or wasn't sure about, you know. So I kind of wanted to get her take on, you know, what she was writing and what it was about.
Mm-hmm.
So by way of answering your question, she said in the interview that I listened to that the book was generally about, and this is what she said. She said something like, how does the book is grappling with the question, how does structural or systemic violence lead to personal violence? And what could that look like? So, and then she talked about her background. So it's interesting because her father was a sociologist or is a sociologist and studied sociology and like human data, for lack of a better word, I believe at the University of Notre Dame, where she went for undergraduate. Her father's an academic, but one of the areas that he focused on was exactly this, was like structural or systemic violence, which I guess means like, you know, like you look at the foster care system, for example, like what kind of negative impact does that have on people over time, you know, and that like big systems like that, whether it's like education or foster care or healthcare or whatever.
The church.
So that's what she said was kind of the overarching question of the whole book. But I sort of feel like, I don't know, there's a part of me that feels like that reflects her father and his work. And I don't want to take anything away from her, because in many ways, this book is a really impressive achievement. But that just feels like sort of an academic way to describe this book. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, well, this book is really about, you know, systemic violence and how that cascades down to the personal and the violence we do to each other. It just seems like a very sort of like scientific way to answer that question.
And it also seems like, not to interrupt you, a good nod towards why it won the National Book Award.
Right.
That kind of thing is like catnip for...
Right.
Like the literary world, you know, systemic violence. Oh man, you know,
right.
Throw some laurels around that.
I want to be careful because I'm not saying I don't believe her, but
right. No, I hear you. I feel similarly.
When I read the book, I felt it was about three different things, and I wrote them down. Or I don't know if "about" is the right word, but there to me there are like kind of three clear strands or elements in the book that made up, you know, what the book was. Now, I already mentioned that you said it's really about love. That was not one of them. So that's another possibility. But for me, it was like, okay, you already mentioned it. There's like an interest in, well, there's a major theme through the book where that keeps coming back. It's right there in the opening epigraph of the book, having to do with, you know, specifically female mysticism within the Christian church, but mm-hmm. you know, spirituality, you said, mysticism, the idea of, you know, being transported out of your body. And she obviously has an interest in, because it comes up several times in the novel, like female mystics across the history of the Christian church. So that's one strand. Another one that comes back again and again that I thought was interesting is just like life. I don't know how to say it really. But, you know, how our lives are influenced by technology, like personal technology. So mm-hmm. smartphones, social media,
even the news, the 24-hour news cycle. She definitely keeps coming back to that, the ways that social media or the ways that technology impact, you know, intertwines with our lives and impacts how we feel about ourselves and other people. So that's another strand. And then a third one, which is very clear to me in the book, is, and again, it's hard to know how to say this, but it's, you know, female characters or females in general feeling uncomfortable in their own bodies. And in some ways, like there's at least one character, but other characters maybe kind of reflect this too. You know, especially if you're a beautiful or pretty person, how you feel trapped inside your body because of your beauty.
Mm-hmm.
And then along with that, the male, like the male response to female beauty, like and it, what is often called the male gaze or male sexual predation. You know what I mean? So like there's one character in particular that, you know, this is kind of like a large part of her life, just kind of grappling with the way she's a pretty person. She's described that way, the way males see her and the ways that she's uncomfortable with that. And that, I mean, literally on the first page of the book, you hear this character says that she left her body. And you realize when you read the book, you kind of realize that one of her whole goals in life is to kind of just get out. She feels trapped within herself and to get outside of that somehow.
Yeah. Very good point. Yeah. I don't know if I saw that all the way through.
Well, and I was going to say too, like, and this is jumping ahead, but there are several points in the book that felt to me like, are we hearing the character here or are we hearing the author, you know, which is, and that's inevitable, you know, they're obviously connected, but, I couldn't help. There's certain like speeches or passages where a character is speaking that I felt very much like we're kind of getting the author's point of view here. But what I was going to say was you don't have to be Sherlock Holmes or Sigmund Freud or a combination thereof to, you know, you take one look at Tess Gunty. She's young. She happens to be beautiful. I mean, I think that's objectively clear. And the only reason I bring that up is it just felt to me like she, you know, this is obviously a part of her life. She said as much in the interview that I heard. She said she didn't call herself beautiful, but she says, you know, I lived on my own in New York City and I could feel men's eyes on me a lot. And after a while you feel like you have a target on your back, which I think is a totally valid expression, by the way, you know, like not that she needs me to tell her that, but I think that's a really valid point. But that is clearly a thread in this book through this character, Blandine. And you just can't help but wonder, you know, part of, you know, that's got to be part of her own experience, sadly.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, you know,
that was a long answer, but that those are the three strands that I identified in the book that I think she's playing with. But she herself kind of nods to the more, you know, the macro level, the ways that systems kind of affect individuals and how that, you know, carries over to the way they treat others. And given that many of her characters are coming through the foster system, you know, that's in there as well.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's a lot in there to your answer, but I think you handled it well, but like there's definitely a theme of like quote unquote, the patriarchy in this novel. And although I'm going to be careful too, but it brought to my mind a lot, you know, I agree that you felt like you were hearing the author mingled with the character. And like you said, you look at her, you kind of can understand it.
Right.
But it brought to my mind a lot, something that I've always kind of wondered about in my life. Maybe a lot of us men do, but I always found it in a very unenviable place. If you happen to be a beautiful woman in particular, maybe just because I'm a man, but, you know, and you had, attention all the time and probably a lot of unwanted attention because of because of your appearance.
Right.
I could see that writing about that as well. I totally sympathize with that, although I share none of those qualities. But like, you know, you probably have a lot to say about that if you were a novelist, and that comes through. And that, I think like you, I agree that that's valid. Yeah. Although I didn't necessarily see that as the main thrust of the book, but maybe it is. I don't know what would be the main thrust of the book. Those are some of the things that I thought of. You know, go ahead.
I'll just make one quick point there. And that's, you know, in the first page, you have this young woman who it's clear that she wants to get out of her body, and she does. It's announced on the first page. She exits her body, and then the last pages are about that same woman and kind of the aftermath of the experience that allowed her to exit her body. So, I mean, those are the bookends of the book. So, you know, it's definitely a big part of the book, I think. Whether that was intentional or not, I think it's a major strand in the book.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree with that.
Sorry, I probably threw you off your point.
A little bit, but we're just hooking and jabbing here because I want to engage my discussing the book. But, you know, a lot of the things that you're saying are making me think about it. And so I'm just trying to decide kind of like where to shift. But I want to talk about something else a little bit down the road, but let's pick up there on the experience, the whole mystical aspect of the book, the mystic aspect of the book. I thought, John, I want to know what you think, but I thought that you said on the first page, the first sentence says she exited her body, and the whole book keeps coming back around to Blandine reading about female mystics. I think her name comes from one of the female mystics, if I'm not mistaken, her new name, Blandine.
Yeah.
And then it's all leading to some point where you know you're going to find out that she did exit her body. I mean, the whole book kind of counts down towards it. But I found the actual exit of the body or the actual experience that was purported to be this mystical experience at the end of the book, it wasn't even very clear to me, and it was definitely like a letdown. I thought it was going to be I don't know if I want to say elaborated more on, but kind of like taken on more directly and more plausible as like this mystical spiritual experience. I didn't find it that way at the end. What did you think about the whole aspect of Blandine herself having these spiritual hang-ups of the interest in the mystics and then the event, you know, we can do some spoilers, but the event that actually led her to kind of leaving her body. I mean, did you buy that in the character of Blandine? Did you buy the interest in the first place? Or did that not hang you up? What did you think about that? Was that realistic to you? You know, this woman having the mystical, very intense hang up on female mystics?
I mean, I did buy it when I was reading the book. You're doing the same thing to me, making me question my own reading, but I'll... But
well, I guess that's the name of the game here with this podcast, I guess.
Yeah, I like what you said, hooking and jabbing. That's a perfect way to describe it. That was good. But I did buy it, but I think part of the reason I buy it again is because I felt like the main character in this novel is in many ways reflective of the author, you know. And I knew about the author that she went to the University of Notre Dame. She had a Catholic upbringing, so she would have been exposed to church history. And I can buy that she, Tess Gunty, really would get interested in the female mystics. And I feel like that carried over into the book. So, and I'm not saying that I feel like Blandine is Tess Gunty, you know, she would, I'm sure, vigorously resist that. And I don't think that's what she's going for. But much of her appears to me to have bled into that character. So that was not a hang up for me. Because she's described also, it's worth saying that the character, her name is Tiffany, but she changes her name to Blandine, you find out during the novel, and there are passages with Tiffany and Blandine, and they're the same person. So and they jump backward and forward in time. So you kind of get an idea of, you get a fleshed out portrait of who this young woman is and some of the experiences that have formed her, let's put it that way. And one of the things that's brought out is that she's very, very intelligent. So she wins this prestigious scholarship to this private high school because of her brains, you know,
And she's also very quirky. So I could buy that she maybe, if she had come across the writings of female mystics from like the Middle Ages, I could buy that she would get into that. That wasn't a hang up for me. Now, you brought up the ending, and I guess we'll get to that more, but like you, from what I'm gathering, and I hope we get a little bit more from you, just kind of in general, what you feel about the whole thing, because I feel like I've been doing a lot of talking. But when we get to the ending and the experience that she has that allows her or makes her exit her own body, I had a lot of problems with the ending too. Like, and mm-hmm. you know, it's her book. So it's like, you know, the ending is the ending in a way, but like in terms of like credibility, in terms of like what is really happening here. And it, you know, the ending, it's talked about in interviews and even on the Jackie copy, I think the ending, the book culminates in an act of violence. So,
right.
Just the idea that this act of violence, which is perpetrated against her, is also somehow a mystical experience, is a little hard to, understand. But then again, you know, she does, I'm just thinking out loud here, but Tess Conti brings up a couple examples of female mystics who were martyred or who, you know, their lives ended in an act of violence too, you know? So I think she's trying to draw a through line there perhaps as well. So in that sense, she's definitely connecting Blandine to like some of the medieval mystics who were martyrs. You know, she's making her into a martyr in a way.
Yeah.
But the question is, I, you know, whether the ending was believable or not, I think it works for what she was trying to do. But I did find the ending very, very abrupt. And I have other questions about the ending as well. So, like, you know, I guess we'll get into that in a little bit. But, you know, we're ping-ponging all over the place. But to get back to the meat of your question, I did not find it too hard to swallow that this character was, you know, somehow gained an interest in the female mystics. And I want to say one other thing. Can I make one other point about that? Because I thought a lot about that.
Yeah.
So I think one of the aspects of this novel that I came to admire actually was this thread of the female mystics. At first, it kind of seems just like a quirk or a device that maybe she's using. But let's see if I can say this. Like I came to realize that struggling how to say this. Like, it specifically when it comes to the Catholic Church, I feel like the female mystics, that tradition represents sort of an alternative tradition to what has historically been a male dominated church. I think nobody can dispute that, right? Like,
right.
The boys have been in charge all the way from the beginning to now. And, but
it's true.
The history and the strand of female mysticism that runs through the church's history often confronted the male leadership of the church. You know, like St. Catherine of Siena definitely did. There are other female mystics who were, you know, consultants to popes, and they often were very critical of the direction of the church. So I can see both with this character and with Tess Conti, perhaps, you know, this being a fruitful theme to explore with very, very valid feelings of this disenchantment and maybe frustration about being a woman in the church. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm struggling with how to say it, but I came to admire this strand of the book because I feel like if, as a woman, if Tess Gunty wants to criticize the church and is interested in a strand of church history where women were able to speak for themselves and to critique the church, I think that's a pretty interesting, I think that's a valid outlet for her to explore as a woman in the church. Does that make, I don't know.
I think I understand what you're saying. And I did some reading of interviews with her and stuff. I know she's somebody who was very devout as a young person. And then she's kind of seems to have moved away from the church from the Catholic Church.
Okay.
Partially because of the patriarchal nature of that church.
Right.
But you can tell that, and I have a friend who's done that, a very wise woman and somebody I've worked with for many years and like a lot, but she kind of moved away from the Catholic Church for the same reasons. She had some very deep feelings about spirituality and, you know, but found it very difficult. Ultimately, she was not able to get over the fact that, you know, in a way, women just didn't have any role in, just didn't have any role, you know?
Right.
So I can, I find that kind of, I, you know, it's not my place. I find that credible too, just personally, you know, and this is, you know, this character and this interest in the mystics is a way, I agree with you, it's kind of a way to explore some of that. And also to me, it's like the remnant or residue of a person. I don't know Tess Gunty. I can't speak for her, but at least of my friend, I feel like even though she left the church, there's part of her that's always going to be interested in the Catholic Church specifically and almost kind of yearning for it, if not in a emotional way, but like kind of almost a spiritual or intellectual way. Like it kind of leaves a space in her that I'm not sure she's going to be able to fill in other places. I don't know.
Right.
I don't know in the case of my friend or Tess Gunty, but you know, the fact that she was so interested in exploring spirituality at all and the female mystics, it tells me there's some part of her that, you know, still has a finger in like Christianity or Catholicism or what have you. So, and it's also just very rare that you see these themes explored in a contemporary novel to begin with.
True.
So that was engaging to me. Now, let me pause there. I'm going to suggest a quick break, John. I don't mean to be abrupt.
No, I agree.
Wanted to get your thoughts on that. And then I'm going to throw you another. I'm going to, when we come back on, I'm going to do a little reading of some things. And then I want you to comment on kind of a different aspect of the book. And then maybe we'll just kind of broaden it out and I can drop like the formal questions. There's a couple more, but I can drop the formal questions. We can just boot it back and forth in the remainder of the program. Does that sound okay to you?
Yeah, I don't mind the questions as a way to kind of just, you know, steer the conversation. But the only thing is I hope that we get enough of your take on the book as well as mine.
Well, I kind of did this by design because I felt like I talked a lot in the last two episodes. And I know you probably don't agree with that, but, you know, I'm running the show. So we're going to do it my way.
Well, that's true. That's true. all right. Yeah, let's take a quick break and we'll come right back into it here.
All right, let's do that.
All right.
All right, John, we are back. We're going to take it in a slightly different direction, but I believe you wanted to make a point first, so the floor is yours.
The only thing I wanted to say, dude, is like, you know, sort of apropos to us, but also the history of this show in a way. I was just curious, like one of the books that kind of kept coming back to into my head as I was reading this one was and now I'm blanking on the name. Daniel Hornsby, Via Negativa. That was a book that, not that the stories aren't similar at all, but there is sort of a thread of like, not Christian mysticism, but, you know, Christian history, Catholic history, a little bit of like, you know, monasticism. And that was another, you know, a debut novel that was sort of grappling with spiritual themes. I'm just curious, did that book come up to you at all?
Well, I want to call a quick audible here. Okay. I'll get back to the question I was going to ask.
Okay.
But based on your comment, because one of my other questions was, John, we're twins. But I thought about this a lot, and I have it written down. I'll read it exactly as I have written it down. Did the Rabbit Hutch bring any other debut novels to your mind?
Huh.
Because I was thinking, John, down similar lines. I didn't think of Via Negativa, but that's another good one. I'm going to throw you out a couple other titles that came back to me. And by the way, this was involuntary. They just kind of were coming into my mind. I didn't even necessarily know why.
Hmm.
So I thought about it a little, and I could comment on that a little bit, but I thought of the novel White Teeth by Zadie Smith.
Huh.
which was her debut novel, and I'll explain, because that didn't have a lot of spiritual elements necessarily. But I think I was thinking more about the unruliness and the tendency to want to jam in whatever has been on your mind in your MFA program or whatever it is mm-hmm. for 5 or 6 years. I thought of The White Teeth by Zadie Smith, definitely a connection there in my mind, which, by the way, is a very strong comparison because that was another very splashy debut back around 2000. I thought of The Five Wounds by Kirsten Valdez Quaid.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that we talked about last year. I thought even a little bit, and again, this was involuntary, about the book, which I've only read once, and it's been many years, A Confederacy of Dunces by John Kennedy Toole. And then when there was something really scratching at me when I was reading it, and I finally realized after I got past the one chapter that's all graphic images, which I thought was of limited value. And other chapters that took different forms. The book that I finally realized I was thinking of was A Visit from the Goon Squad by Jennifer Egan, and which was not a debut novel, and I consider it to be, frankly, a better book, but it also won the Pulitzer Prize. But you remember the infamous PowerPoint chapter in A Visit from the Goon Squad?
Sure.
That was debated a lot, and people had different opinions, and I think that's a very flattering comparison for Tess Gunty. But I think Tess Gunty, I agree with what you said at the very outset. Like, there's a lot of talent and promise that's done on broad display in this book. But I thought of all those books. I think it has less to do, John, with the spiritual qualities. Some cases it applies, I guess, like Kirsten Valdez Quaid, for example. But all of those books felt to me like, you know, I guess I would say like a big ideas book, or like a pastiche of like many different topics that were of interest to the writer that they kind of jammed into the book in some way with varying degrees of success, even though most of those books I think are pretty good books. And I think The Rabbit Hutch is a pretty good book. But there was this sense that, you know, she was dumping in. It felt very similar to those other novels that I mentioned in a way. Even John Kennedy Toole, which is a roundly regarded as kind of a classic. But it does bear, it has no story resemblance, but it does has kind of a quirky character, and it's got a lot of like ideas and kind of big thoughts in that book and commentary. So all those books came to my mind, and I do think that the Daniel Hornby is a good example. Daniel Hornsby's first novel is a good example also, although that did not come to my mind to answer your question. I don't know, what do you think? Like, did you well, that's my original question. Did it bring any other debut novels to your head in a similar way?
There was the only ones I can remember. Like, it definitely made me think of Via Negativa. And there was another one that came to mind, which I forgot. It's not one of the ones you just mentioned, but maybe I'll remember. But there was another novel I was thinking of. I didn't think specifically of any of those other ones, though I will say from the interview that I heard, I mean, it's interesting. I think Tess Gunty would be thrilled and flattered that you thought of both Zadie Smith and A Visit from the Goon Squad, because she cited both of those writers as influences.
Yeah.
Certainly, the book A Visit from the Goon Squad is one that she had read that definitely was a direct influence on this book. So
I can see that. Yeah.
Yeah, you're right about that. And you're right to also point out, I didn't think of it, but to point out, you know, that one novel that's told in graphic images, which I totally agree, by the way, with what you said. I didn't find it that helpful at all. I didn't even find the images that striking. You know, some of them were, but I thought that was sort of...
They were made by her brother. They were made by her brother.
Oh, okay. She's, well, apologies for brother. Her brother. I mean, they're good images, but I, you know, they just... I felt like that was an experimental element that wasn't really necessary, frankly.
And by the way, I you know how big of an admirer I am of Jenny Egan. I mean, I love Jennifer Egan.
Yeah.
But I don't like her PowerPoint chapter either. And I thought that was not up to the rest of the book.
Oh, that's interesting, because I really liked the PowerPoint chapter in that book. I thought that was
fascinating.
I thought that was very creative. And kind of gutsy. I mean, the graphic
definitely.
the graphic images one in this book, it just, you know, it's just a way for her not to have to explain what happened. But some of the images, I found myself looking like, what am I even looking at here? But anyway, so
yeah.
But the other novels you mentioned, we don't have to dwell on this too much. I think the one that really stands out, this is, again, it's like your other point about maybe the book really being about, you know, the desire to be loved, which I think there's a lot of resonance there, is the comparison to Confederacy of Dunces, which did not come to my mind at all. But there's also, I mean, there's more to it than that even than what you mentioned, because there's very much a Middle Ages theme in that novel. You know,
oh, that's true. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, like, the Middle Ages are a big presence in that book. And in a way, they are here in a different way, but still. Because he's playing a lot with the age of chivalry and...
Great point.
And Tesconti's focused on a different aspect of that time period. But still, that's another commonality between the two books. But, yeah, those are interesting associations that you made. I didn't make them all, but there's clearly, as we've made the point a number of times here, there's clearly a lot in the blender with this novel.
Yes.
And a lot of it is really interesting stuff. A lot of it is really interesting stuff. Like I already mentioned, like, the three or four strands that I felt were, you know, made up the book. And, you know, most of those I find really interesting, but, you know, the technology one, which we haven't focused on too much, but, you know, she goes again and again into, she mentions, like, you know, personal technology. One point in the book, you know, I actually wrote this down because I thought this, I enjoyed the comment on personal technology, but I thought at one point she described somebody, you know, it was two lovers in a bed, I think, and one was touching the other and said, you know, stroking her because she was of such high value, like a cracked iPhone. I almost threw the book across the room at that point because I thought, oh, come on. Like, you know, in other words, she kind of overstepped herself, in my opinion, at times. Like she had such great value, like a cracked iPhone. And I thought, well, that's the cult of Apple right there, which is ubiquitous, you know, in our time. That's preposterous. I mean, I'm sorry.
Well, it may have been sarcastically or satirically intended, but
it may have been. You know, I didn't.
You wonder it, though.
I didn't read it that way. But it might have been, or it might have just been, you know, the character's point of view. But I thought that was sort of ridiculous. But anyway, we're kind of losing the thread here. So let's get back on track. But there's just so much going on in this novel. I said we weren't going to do two parts, but we probably could.
Yeah, but we're not. So I have another question. Like I said, been threatening, I'm going to take it in another direction. But just one more comment on that. And you touched on this earlier when you were talking about, you know, the sort of messy nature. I think messy is a good word for it, of this novel, this debut novel. And you know, of course, there's like probably a really long tradition of messy first novels. It almost feels like it's kind of regrettable, but it almost feels like you got to have that messy early book when you're learning to write novels, basically, and write fiction. And I bet you later on in her career, if she continues to write novels, she'll have more streamlined and more focused books. But, you know, as we're talking about, I'm thinking about stuff like The Town and the City by Jack Kerouac, you know, is this big debut novel that's very messy and very kind of ambitious, but it led to a much more streamlined and, you know, world classic On the Road, you know. Or, there was another good example. The Broom of the System was the debut novel by David Foster Wallace. You know, doesn't totally apply here because he went on to write a bigger and messier book that he's more famous for, Infinite Jest. But I remember being very struck by The Broom of the System because it had, and it's been years since I read The Broom of the System. It was a very funny book, but it was just a big, messy conglomerate of, like, weird stuff. You know, it was a very debut book, you know.
Yeah, there's another one that jumps to mind, which I know you haven't read, but you gave to me, which was by Joshua Cohen, and it's called The Book of Numbers.
Oh yeah,
I don't. I'm not sure if that was his debut, but he was young when he wrote it, and that's another book that has strands of technology in it, and it's kind of big and messy. Had a lot going on in it, and like I felt like some of it worked, but some of it didn't. So anyway,
yeah, you kind of got lost a little bit, but anyway, okay, let's do my pivot here.
Yeah,
because I'm interested in talking about this. And you won't be surprised about this because of, I feel like I do too much talking about the fact that I like to write books also. But, this is this is the kind of thing that I would be interested in. So I thought it would fit in here.
Sure.
To touch on some of that. But to set it up, I'd like to, it's not even really a question, but I want to talk a little bit about the actual writing in this book. And I caught some lines that I thought were striking one way or another. I'm just going to read them. And then why don't you take a run at what you think about her writing itself?
Okay.
Because I was very struck by it. I thought it was very strong.
Yeah.
I would agree. One of the great strengths of the book was the good writing. And there were many lines that I thought were notable. Some of them are, you could say, well, I don't like that or whatever. Almost made you chuck the book across the room, but they were notable. They stood out one way or another, just a few of them. There was one phrase that she used early in the book where she likened something to what she called existential pool noodles, which I thought was a kind of a funny phrase. I don't know if it totally works, but she's like, she relied upon these things like existential pool noodles. I thought that was funny. That made me laugh. I've never heard that phrase. There was one case, you probably noticed this, John, in one of the spiritual passages where I think Blandine is speaking, but she describes an image of Veronica as Jesus, an image of Veronica with the cloth. Oh,
yeah.
In a painting as Veronica holding a selfie.
You're right.
Which I thought was a very interesting way to put that. I never thought of that. I don't know if it totally works, but it was, again, striking. Well, she used a phrase once called – I'm sorry, you want to say something?
Just very quick. That's an example of what I was talking about. Like she definitely uses references to modern technologies throughout the book in creative ways. Yes. I mean –
That's right.
On the very first page of the book where she's talking about the woman's mystical experience that we've already talked about, she says something like – let me find it real quick because I wrote it down. Oh, shite. I can't find it now. Oh, man. Oh, boy. And in the very first couple paragraphs, she says something about... Oh, why can't I find it? Damn it. I can't find it. Something about... She compares herself to, like, an algorithm. Oh. She's describing her mystical experience on the first page of the book, and she says she refers to herself as an algorithm for amplified content. describing this mystical experience. So just to link it back to what you just said, like just kind of using modern technology and working them into the prose in various surprising ways is definitely an interesting aspect of this book. Sorry.
Right. Yeah. And you wonder if it's like conscious or not conscious. Is it just a sign of her generation? I don't know. Maybe a little of both. Did I say this one, melanoma of the spirit?
No.
She uses the phrase melanoma of the spirit once. I thought that was interesting.
Huh.
Here's something that's interesting in a different way. It's just that this is the kind of thing that I see as catnip for judges on some panel. She sips from a straw that will probably end up in a whale.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought that was, kind of a catnip type of line, but it was, a way to throw in some side commentary, I guess.
Lots of lines like that where she kind of makes a gesture or a point about contemporary life or points to a contemporary problem.
Right.
In a very creative way.
Right. And, she's probably not entirely wrong. And then here's the last one. This is a whole sentence, but this one I really did like, although I'm not totally sure it works, but it, again, it was striking to me. Stood out, and I think her writing stood out, you know, which I would give her a lot of credit for, because it's not easy to do that, like consistently sustain that through a whole novel. But she writes at one point, there's something morally puny about the son, something like the person who throws up her hands in the middle of a debate and cries, "I don't take sides," you know. Now, I'm not totally sure what that means, but I thought it was an interesting way to phrase your a sentence, you know.
That's a weird one. Yeah.
But yeah, it is. It is weird. But in general, what did you think about it sounds like you agree with me that it was strong. Would you call it like a really strongly well-written book, or would you say it just has moments, or what would you say?
I think in general, yes, it's a very well-written book. I thought there are lots of instances of what we're both talking about, of how, like, yeah, turns of phrase or sentences where, again, a lot of times it involves technology, where she'll throw in a specific reference to a technology or something tech-related that, you know, reflects back on a person's state of mind. And I thought there was something interesting going on there, because it happens again and again. I have another example for you. Or it doesn't even have to be technology, like the pool noodles, but a lot of times it is, like the cracked iPhone.
But yeah,
like, this is another one. She said, "I thought this was really interesting. Very interesting." She said she's not talking about technology, but she works it in. She says she's describing a character and her instability. She's certain she has some kind of social impairment. She's just not sure what it's called. Internet quizzes never knew what to do with her. And I thought, that is such a strange thing to throw in there, but it made me laugh. Like, I'm like, you know, it's a very modern, you know, allusion, but it's just, it's a weird way to throw that in there, but it works. It's like, you know, yeah, the algorithms didn't know how to parse her, you know, like it's strange.
Yeah. Or like she was confusing animal even to technologies, you know, like,
right. And I think to go back to one of your questions, yeah, I think that is deliberate. I give her a lot of credit for that. Cause it, you know, you start to notice it like a pattern there. I wrote down other examples too. I'm not going to be able to find them, but you know, it comes up again and again, like the cracked iPhone. There's a scene where, thought this was another good one. And then I'm going to give you another example of what we were just talking about. Then I'm going to give you two lines that I wrote down because they're just hilarious. Like, they made me literally laugh out loud.
Okay.
So another technology reference in the context of a human interaction here, where there's a character, and I don't even know if we're going to get to this character, but I would like to in another conversation, because I didn't know what to make of this person, but character's name Moses. And mm-hmm. he's having this impromptu confession with a priest in a Catholic church.
Yeah.
And he tells the priest something that's like really kind of shocking. And she writes, "Father Tim pauses again, like a GPS system recalculating after a wrong turn." And I thought,
yeah,
that totally makes sense. Like,
yeah,
you know, right, it's like he had to recalibrate to react to what the guy had just told him.
Knocked off course, you know?
Yeah. It's just lots of examples like that, but they're
very smart line. Yeah.
Yeah. To go back to your, and it's deliberate. I believe it is deliberate, because again and again, she alludes to technologies and in the context of human interactions. I don't think that's an accident. And I found that to be a really interesting through line throughout the book. But I mean,
yeah, poor Tess Gunty. She's smart and beautiful. Yeah, it must be hard.
Yeah, no, I for sure. She's also very, like, there's a lot of wit in this book. These are two lines that just made me laugh out loud that I have to bring up. One is earlier in the book, and it involves these side characters, which frankly I didn't find amounted to much, the characters. But there is this older couple that lives in one of the apartments in the rabbit hutch. They're named Reggie and Ida. You know, they're only in the book here and there. You remember them?
Yeah. Yeah, I do.
So they're having a conversation about just all kinds of stuff, like older people do. And they're commenting on their kids. And the wife says, or it says, "We should have tried something different," said Ida. "One of those barefoot schools, piano lessons, vitamins, no gluten. None of the kids turned out right."
I
laughed out loud at that because I thought it's very funny, but it talk about tapping into like modern parental anxieties.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I just went like one of those barefoot schools, you know, alternative school, piano lessons, vitamins, no gluten. I mean, these are like, these are most of these things are things I've thought of with my own kids. I thought that was really funny. And then,
yeah. There's another, go ahead.
Just really quick. There's another just very funny line. It's kind of modern, but one guy's just talking in conversation. He goes, "Cheated on me with some startup douche." Maybe that's redundant. Startup douche. I laughed out loud. Very funny. I thought that's freaking hilarious.
It's like a redundancy, yeah. You know, like a. Well, she has this way of, and this is another sign of an impressive debut novel, because, you know, I don't know what she's about, but like, you know, I don't know what she knows about having a baby, or I don't know what she knows about parenting. I know she's not a mother and she's not a parent, you know, didn't have a baby and is not a parent. Mm-hmm. And she writes some pretty wise things about experiences it does not seem like she has had personally. You know, I don't know, you know, like, you know, what she knows or what she doesn't. But I'm impressed. What I'm saying is I'm impressed that she could write, come up with wise lines about experiences she did not have. It's like trying to, you know, like, I know in my experience for many years, like, I was too intimidated to even try to write, like, a female character, for example, because I just wasn't there, you know? And she's still, like, a relatively young writer, and she has the ability to put herself in other people's shoes, which is quite a skill for a novelist, you know?
Yeah, I actually wrote down one of those lines because she says this. She's talking about a young mother early in the book, someone who had just given birth to a baby.
Yes.
That she is discovering that pregnancy, birth, and postpartum recovery comprise three acts of a horror film no one lets you see before you live it.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
that's a great line. I mean, again, to your point, like, as far as we know, she hasn't been pregnant or had kids. So that's impressive, but I think there are a lot of mothers who would resonate with. It's supposed to be
absolutely, yeah.
It's supposed to be this beautiful experience, and it's in some ways it's kind of a horror movie, and that the woman character is grappling with that, and I think that's interesting.
Yeah, it's like that clip I think you sent me once from this female comedian who was joking about people telling women in the modern era, "You can have it all. You don't have to be just a mother or a career woman. You can do it all." And she's like, you don't want it all.
Yeah.
You know, like, she's like, having it all isn't a good thing. You know, like, it was just, she was riffing on that, which is kind of funny.
Right.
But anyway, can I pivot again as a way of kind of rounding out?
Yeah. Let's see how we're doing on time here. Cause there's a part of the book, like you asked about writing, and there's a specific chapter in the novel that I had, I mentioned this to you off air, that really kind of rubbed me the wrong way. So, like, to me, it fits in this discussion before we pivot, but I don't know if you don't think we'd have time.
I mean, we can do what we want. I mean, yeah, why don't you bring it up and we'll talk about it, and then we'll see how much time we have left. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask you about the conclusion of the book, and we're going to have some spoilers there. And then I even want to talk about the very last line of the book, which I wrote down if you don't have it noted. But if you want to bring up a specific chapter and riff on that, you know, we're the bosses. Go ahead.
I'll try to do it quickly because you did ask about writing, and there was one part of there were a few places in the book where, and I've alluded to this already, where I kind of felt like, you know, you could sort of tell, it almost sounded less like a novel and more like a college thesis or something. Like she was just kind of expressing a lot of her ideas about whatever. Maybe it's the church. Maybe it's the patriarchy. And there were times in the book where I felt like, and I don't know this for sure, but it kind of felt like, are we still in the book, or is this kind of like the author just kind of getting her feelings out about, you know? But there's one chapter in the book, it's called I Leave It Up to You, and it was the long chapter where, so one of the plot threads of this book that we didn't mention is that Tiffany, who changes her name to Blandine, who's kind of the main character, a part of her backstory is she has this affair with a teacher at her high school when she was like 16 or 17, and the teacher's like 40 or 41. And it really, in a lot of ways, it kind of messed her up, but it's a big strand in the book. And then there's a chapter, which is called I Leave It Up to You, where they kind of, after the affair is over, and so some time has passed, and they meet again, and they kind of hash it out between each other, or they have this long conversation. And that chapter, like, just, it really kind of, I thought it sort of slowed the book down. It also, because it's pretty long, and there are like long rants with this young woman about the affair, about this man, about, you know, how all the culpability is his. And, you know, they kind of went back and forth. But there's a whole long section in this chapter that I just thought, man, like, I just think this sort of goes off the rails. But, you know, it becomes like this just kind of like rant or diatribe against the whole system sort of, or against like, you know, all of masculinity, you know, from the point of view of femininity, you know, like it just kind of, it was like a river that sort of spilled over the banks. The banks of the book and just started just going off, you know? And I found I didn't find it that believable. I know she's a smart character, but it just felt to me like, it was one of these moments where it was like, okay, like, are we still in the book though? Or is this just,
yeah, who's talking here?
I mean, I was going to read a long passage, but we don't have time, but you know, she's talking about, you know, my obsession with you doesn't mean our relationship wasn't, look, we were concepts rather than individuals is what I'm trying to say. Idiotic ions within a geomagnetic storm. You see? And for months, I convinced myself that you and I had transcended the power structures at play, that I was an equal agent, that to blame you would be to infantilize myself, etc. A little bit later down in the same paragraph, I just thought, like, this has just gone beyond the bounds of credibility for me. We were not two people simply succumbing to an inconvenient, taboo, totally hackneyed attraction. We were cogs in a superstructure of class and state and production and distribution and legislation and political pyramids and militias and exchange rates and national debts and fossil fuels and stuff. We were stuck in a web of material relations. I think actually at the end of the day, we were the answer to the question, what are grand pianos for? and because she, you know, she makes a reference to a grand piano that he owned, and you know, because the teacher she got into an affair with was rich, you know, so he had this grand piano that she thought was like great and like, I don't know. But I mean, this whole passage to me is just like, what, I just didn't believe it. It just felt like you know what it felt like? Remember that scene in Good Will Hunting that everybody, you know, with the ridiculous intellectual bar fight between Matt Damon's character and some, you know, pretentious guy from like an Ivy League school. And they have this like brain off instead of like, where they're quoting from arcane passages from different books. It's like, remember that? The first time you see it, you're like, oh, this is incredible. Wow. This script is unbelievable. The second time you see it, you go, oh, okay, maybe it's pushing credibility a little bit. The third time you see it, you go, this is the stupidest effing scene I've ever seen in my whole life. And it doesn't even remotely correspond to reality in any way. It's just, it's so contrived. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, you're making a very good point about that chapter.
This chapter felt like that as well. Like, it just goes off the rails, in my opinion. she's saying, you know, this young woman is like, our relationship is like systematic oppression and fossil fuels and the patriarchy and stuff like that. And it's just like, no, I just don't buy it. Like, nobody talks like that. So,
well,
I'm going to let you talk in 10 seconds. I guess my general point is, while the writing is very impressive, it's like, you know, pyrotechnic in places and really witty and really smart. I felt that there were times where it almost becomes a parody of itself, like that scene in Good Will Hunting, and it just turns into something kind of ridiculous.
Okay. Well, great point. Great segue.
Okay.
I don't know. Okay. You okay with that?
I'm sorry. I'm talking way too much and not letting you take it where you want to go.
No. I don't care. Who cares? You know, it's just, we're riffing on the book. That's a great commentary. I think it was worth jamming in. So good instinct there. John, that's, you know, I don't want to embarrass you. That's what I'm talking about with your critical faculty, because I think that's a smart read on it. And John, I know how bad this is going to sound. I keep thinking, for some reason, and this more than likely isn't going to be the case, but for some reason during this whole episode, I think about Tess Gunty listening to it, you know, which she's probably not going to do, and how she would react to what we're saying about them. But John, I totally hear you. I think that is a very valid point. And what's coming up in my mind is, and this sounds really pretentious and arrogant. I'm sorry, but the word for that is youth, isn't it? In a way,
yeah.
Like Matt Damon and Ben Affleck were like 26 when they wrote that.
Yeah.
And it doesn't age well. And I think you're right about that. What's interesting is that I don't know what that says to me about me as a reader, because I think some of that might have made me laugh or go like, what? But I didn't stumble over it as hard as you did. I think you're totally right. Even as you were reading it, it sounds like a screed.
Yeah.
Or polemic or something, whatever the right word is. And not only that, but it sounds like a paper, you know?
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think forgive me, Otis Gunty. But if you are hearing this, I wonder whether or not she would agree, you know, with your characterization of that chapter. Now, I don't know.
I'm sure she would.
You know, maybe not. But we all find, you know, especially in our debut novels, you know, speaking as a writer with much less success than Ms. Gunty, but we all find stuff to cringe over in our first books. God knows that.
Yeah.
You know, or stuff we would go back and look at. Now, she's been very successful, deservedly so. I want to make that clear. I think, you know, I'm not sure either if it should have won the National Book Award, but it is a very striking debut, you know, right. Just to skip to the bottom line. You know, it's definitely worth reading, and I would encourage people to read it,
right.
You know, who are interested in contemporary literature. But I wonder if she might agree with that. I think that's a very fair point. I think at least cutting it, you know, in half, because I remember it being a long chapter, would probably have the same effect. And when you get into things like, you know, what is the purpose of a grand piano?
No.
It's funny, but that does strain credibility. And I totally agree with your sentence. Like, you know, are we still in the book here? You know?
Yeah.
So all those things I think are valid. You know, it doesn't mean it's less of a book. I think I still think it's a very strong novel. But
well, to think of someone in real life saying, you know, ultimately this whole relationship could come down to this question, and that is, what are grand pianos for? It is just a ridiculous, you know.
Yeah.
I just can't swallow that, but.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it is a youth. She's, by definition, it's a youthful novel, and it sounds condescending, but I think we've noted there's so much that's impressive with it. You know, it's
right.
Really, it's an impressive achievement, but you know, we all go back. Everyone go, like, I've picked up in my garage notebooks, things that I wrote when I was in my 20s. And I just, you know, you're just like, oh man, like I would never,
who is this idiot? You know,
like, I would never write that again, but you know, that's what you've lived another 25 years. So it wouldn't surprise me if she went back to it and said, well, You know, I think I'd write that a little differently now. But then again, you could also argue just keep it the way it is, because that's who she was and where she was at the time.
Right, right. And, you know, I don't care what you say. There's a long road between 30 and 50. I'm not saying anything about our wisdom or anything like that. I mean, she's smarter than I am, you know. But like, you know, I mean, but then again, that you could flip it and say that there's so much promise in this writer, I think. You know, the fact that she's writing on this level at the age of 30 or whatever it is, you know, she keeps writing books. You know, I think the future is bright for her.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah. And it's not.
But anyway,
it's not to quote. I don't even know if you've seen this, but and if you haven't, shame on you. But to quote Wooderson from Dazed and Confused, it's not wisdom, really. It's just living. LIVIN. You know,
like, I have not seen Dazed and Confused. So,
oh my gosh, wow. Anyway, yeah. It's the point is, it's like we're not saying we're wiser than Tescani. We just lived longer. You know?
Yeah, just further down the road. But yeah. So anyway. Let's talk about the end.
Okay.
I really didn't buy the end. I was disappointed by the. Blandine has now left her body aspect of it, mm-hmm. But I really didn't buy any of it. So we're going to get into some spoilers. We haven't talked a lot about the three men, young men she lives with, but they all kind of end up in a kind of a strange competition, unsurprisingly, because they all kind of have the hots for Blandine because she's pretty and whatever,
yep,
and kind of different.
Yep.
And there's one who's aspiring to be an actor who's clearly a better looking, young man. He's a black man, but he's like very handsome. And, you know, the other two are kind of schlubs a little bit.
Yeah.
Anyway, they get into, to make a long story short, they have this, they get into this competition throughout the book about who would kill for Blandine, you know, over the next guy to like impress her enough to win her hand or whatever. And so they start like taking out small animals, like mice and squirrels and stuff. And so basically, you know, to really simplify it, there's this encounter that Blandine has with a goat in the woods towards the end of the book. She rescues the goat and she brings the goat back to their apartment. Didn't make any sense to me. Also, everything about this was kind of not, I didn't buy it very much. I didn't buy killing animals to impress a woman. You know, I don't know. Yeah. I don't know who would do that. I didn't buy her bringing the goat into her room and just letting it live in her room. Nobody would do that. And then they decided that the goat is there and they find out it's there. She had it locked in her room, but she didn't want them to see it. But somebody got in and they decided that they're going to kill this goat, you know, to impress Blandine. And then Blandine comes in from wherever she was. I'm just simplifying it a lot. And they attack the goat, but she throws herself in front of the goat, you know, major spoilers, to protect the goat. So they end up cutting her stomach open 4 or 5 times with a knife, and that's like the big act of violence at the end of the book. And maybe the same time she leaves her body, I wasn't even really clear on that. And then she survives the attack, and then I'll get to the last line of the book in a minute. But, John, I didn't buy any of that. I just don't see that as realistic, that her three young male roommates would – oh, she's in front of the goat. Well, let's just stab her. And none of that made sense to me.
No.
And it, I thought it was, again, I'm not trying to be, you know, who am I next to her success?
Right.
But I thought it was this temptation that, again, a young writer will have to put some kind of cataclysm at the end of a book, frequently a violent one, because it has to have some kind of bang at the end. I've done it myself, you know. And to me, this book didn't need that. It was implausible to me that she would step in front of the goat. It was very implausible they'd stab her, you know, and even implausible she would survive the attack. None of that resonated with me. So just in general, did you buy any of the end of the book?
No, I had an almost identical reaction to the end of the book. Like I
yeah, it's disappointing in a way.
Yeah, I felt like kind of the wheels come off the cart a little bit at the end of the book. And again, you know, overall, I was impressed with this novel. You know, I think there's a lot about it that's really impressive. And to the point where, like, you use the word disappointment. Like, I was really into this book. I mentioned at the very outset of this conversation that I just kind of blew through it.
Right.
I really wanted, I was curious to see where it was going to end up. And I really wanted to know what this mystical experience was about. I mean, I was in. And then, but I did not understand, like, I'm not going to repeat every point you made. I agree with most of them. Like, I just didn't understand why these guys were killing, sacrificing animals. I mean, I guess from a plot perspective, it was to impress her somehow, but it was just like, who does that? Like, and what about the, like, are you just killing them in your apartment? Like, isn't that kind of a mess?
Like, yeah, totally.
I mean, it just didn't feel real the way that some of the other things we discussed do. And then, yeah, I mean, why, if the guy in particular who does the murdering of Blandine is the one who maybe has fallen the hardest and is actually, there's a scene between them where they kind of like, they're on the verge of kissing each other. They're like, there's a connection made and they both feel it. Why would he keep stabbing
her? And cuts her stomach open.
Yeah.
And it should be noted, he didn't murder her, because I just mentioned before that she survived.
Sorry. No, he didn't. And we'll get to the very ending, because I knew that was going to come up. And, you know, the last scene and in particular, the last line, pretty interesting. You know, but yeah, that just, and I already mentioned this, and the way she chose to tell it was through this graphic, like, not graphic in the sense of violence, but like literally, you know, graphic designs that explain what happened. And I thought some of those weren't even very clear. I just feel like I get, it's what you said. You're like, you need some kind of like, you know, cataclysmic event at the end, and it feels like it was sort of bungled to me. And it's a shame, because it's like, it's alluded to on the first page, like so she had the idea, like she was going to have this experience and she's going to leave her body. And I already said, like, you know, the idea, I think she's connecting it somehow to the idea, you know, to some of the martyrs from the past who were, you know, killed and had a mystical experience. Or she specifically references one that was, you know, fed to the lions, but they wouldn't touch her. So they ended up doing all these horrible things to her to try and kill her, you know?
Yeah.
So there's a connection there. Like this group of youths tried to kill her, but she couldn't be killed. Or, I mean, you know, cut her stomach open, and yet she's going to live through that. That's kind of weird. But yeah, I just think, like, I don't know what to say. It was like a big swing at the end. I'm not sure it connected with anything. It was sort of a disappointment for me too.
Yeah. You know, was she trying to say, this sounds defensive, I don't mean it this way, she can do whatever the hell she wants? Was she just trying to, it's so unrealistic they would do that. Is she just trying to make a point about how doofuses these three men were? You know, they would just start killing animals like some macho bullshit, you know? Just to try to impress her? Was she saying that? Or did she believe in her own plot, like the plausibility of it, and she just thought that this was an effective way to end it? Man, I don't know. But it didn't work, you know, like from my perspective. And then, you know, are you still there?
Yeah.
So let's just go to the end. She survives the attack. She's in the hospital at the very end of the book, and she is visited by another person who lives in the rabbit hutch, and they're having this like exchange. And I guess at the very end of the book, I can't totally remember, but it looks like Blandine is like recovering. She might be dozing. And this woman, this older woman is visiting her. And she says, like, you know, I thought you were sleeping, or are you awake? And then the very last line of the book is, I am awake, or I am, are you? And that's the end of the book. I thought that was an interesting last line. I just want to bring – you remember my buddy Andrew Huebner, who I went through the MFA program at the New School with?
Yeah.
We graduated around 2000. He put out two novels. He was one of the rare success stories from that program. He put out two novels that I thought both of them were good. Not flawless, but were good. And the second one was about this Gulf War, like the original Persian Gulf War veteran in the 1991. It was based on the life of his brother, who was a tank commander. I knew that just by getting to know the guy at school. And I read that novel probably 18 years ago. It was called We Pierce. It was Andrew Huebner's second novel. But I remember the last line to this day. And it's comparable to this one. This guy is a, you know, tank commander. Again, it was based on his brother's life in the Gulf War, has these very traumatic experiences, comes home and he's trying to put his life together. And at the very end of the book, he goes out in the middle of the night and he's on his porch in like this house in North Carolina. It's quiet and he's like having a cigarette and just trying to like move forward. And his wife comes out with his brand new baby and he says something at the end. He says, "I thought I scared you." And then the wife, this is the very last line of the book. The wife's holding the baby and she's kind of like shaking him up and down. She says, you don't scare us. And that was the end of the book. And I never knew exactly what that line meant, but I thought it was a really interesting last line. Mm. You know, mm-hmm. "I thought I scared you." She said, "You don't scare us." Mm. You know, mm. And this line reminded me of that. "I'm awake. Are you?" Maybe a hint of a stretch there, but I thought it was interesting. What did you make of that last line?
Kind of the same thing. Like again, there's a little bit of a, well, I wouldn't, I mean, I think it's sort of a conscious attempt to be sort of provocative or leave it like stick the landing, leave it open-ended. But I think it does work with some of the themes that she's playing around with in the book. Obviously, you know, mysticism, trying to find a, you know, leave your body, try to find a higher state of existence or awareness, you know, it kind of,
right.
It, you know, it sort of fits in with that. I think what I found a little bit, maybe more of a strain of credibility is that these two characters have one encounter together early in the book and they have an interesting conversation. And then you don't really hear much about the other character's name, Joan, at all. You know, they come back to her story once or twice, but she's really kind of like in the background of this book. And then she sort of shows up at the very end and visits Landine. And I just kind of, I felt a little bit like she's just sort of being arbitrarily inserted into the end of the book so that we could end on this note of human friendship and connection.
Mm-hmm.
Which is mm-hmm. a good note to end on. And I, you know, I kind of appreciated that it did have a bit of a upbeat at the very end, but it also sort of felt to me a little bit arbitrary because she's one of the characters and there are a couple of them where I felt like they weren't fleshed out all that much. And you kind of not really sure why they're there other than for plot reasons, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, the character Joan starts interesting and she has this interesting job, by the way, where she edits obituaries and she like monitors comments that are made about obituaries.
Yeah.
Which I found it, by the way, sort of hard to believe that there's an entire company that's all they do is like write online obituaries, but maybe there is. Tess Gunn's
you thing. Kind of, you find it kind of like implausible, but you kind of accept it.
You accept it. She said that she actually read about someone who's this was their job, and she found that to be interesting, so she worked it into the book. That's all mm-hmm. well and good, but so you get that early on, and then like I feel like she barely came back to that character. So then mm-hmm. you bring this character back for this final scene, which is supposed to have this impact, and I just found like I maybe it's just me, but I was like, is she really going to go visit this girl that she only had a connection with once. I don't know. It just kind of was a way to tie that thread together and that sort of strained credibility a little bit for me too. But you know, the last line, it's sort of a writerly last line, but it's also interesting and it does work with some of the themes in the book. So like, I think it works, you know what I'm saying? Like it works while at the same time you can sort of feel the cleverness behind it.
Yeah. I had the same reaction, although I would give it more of a thumbs up than a thumbs down. It reminded me a little bit of the last sentence of one of my favorite novels in the world, Mariette and Ecstasy, John.
Yeah.
Where at the very end of the book, Mariette is praying to God and she says, "Surprise me." And that's her last line.
Yeah.
It reminded me a little bit of that. It did feel like a reach toward it, but I, you know, in this sense, like, I like that. I like that, you know, at the very end of the book, I kind of agree with you on why they were coming together in the first place, but I like that swing, you know, trying to hit it out at the end of the book in a way that at least tied back to some of the major themes, you know. And, you know, you get this idea that when she hit on it, she had a really happy moment or like, that's where I'm going to end my book or whatever. I like it more than I don't like it.
I guess I do. I'm thinking of something else too. Like, this comes through in the book, and she also mentioned it in the interview I heard. Like, when she's talking about exiting your body throughout the book, she doesn't necessarily mean for spiritual reasons. She said in this interview, like, I just mean, some people feel trapped in their own body and they just want to escape. Like, in other words, it's not necessarily escaping towards a higher spiritual plane. It's just getting out of whatever you feel trapped in. So,
right.
If that's the case, then I feel like it's a little bit of like, you know, wanting to have your cake and eat it too, because it makes it seem like that question is like, makes it seem like, one of the ideas in the book is like achieving some sort of higher spiritual state, but the book is also about just like freeing yourself from a trap, you know, like, so like, which is it, you know, but maybe we're just, I might be sort of straw splitting here, but it was definitely an interesting note. Like, if you think of a piece of music, it was an interesting note to end on and a, kind of a satisfying one, even though you could sort of like pick it apart, I guess. But, I guess that's sort of how I feel about the whole book. Like, to me, it hits a few false notes, but it's a pretty interesting piece of music.
Yeah, I think, why don't we just leave it there? I think I agree with you by and large. You know, it may have tweaked certain, you know, funny bones or, you know, buttons on me in a certain way, and it may have tweaked certain buttons on you in a certain way. But I think it's safe to say that this is an impressive debut novel. It's worth reading. You know, if anybody has any interest in any of what has gone before on this episode, you should go out and read the book if you haven't. But a very discussion-worthy book, John, I'll say that. And
It was a good pick, Jude. I want to give you some credit because I didn't know anything about this book. And, you know, I think you picked it because you found it interesting, but also because you thought I would find it interesting and it would generate – lots of discussion. I think you hit the mark. So nice work.
Well, as Michael Douglas says in Black Rain, you know, I know I'm just a gaijin, but you get me close and I hit the mark. You know, just kidding.
Thank you. That
was for all you 80s action movies aficionados.
I love it.
Anyway. all right. So that wraps up our discussion of The Rabbit Hutch. And before we're going to talk about what we're going to read. I'm going to go first and then I'm going to throw it to you. And we didn't discuss this at all, but do you want to tease whatever is coming up next?
Yeah. Do you want to mention what you're going to read next first?
Yeah, I'm going to mention my book that I'm going to pick up next, turn it over to you. You talk about what you're going to read next and then tease the next one for us.
Okay. I'll do that. I might hedge a little bit, but you'll see.
Okay, that's fine. So my next book is kind of a zag in another direction after reading the Geddy Lee memoir, although it is nonfiction. This is a book I got from our mother, John, for our birthday, which was recently. I don't know why she picked this out, but I think it looks interesting. And it is called The Stranger in the Woods. And the subtitle of the book is something like... The Story of the Last Hermit. And it's about this guy who decided to go out, a little bit of Christopher McCandless from that famous book, Into the Wild by John Krakauer.
Yeah.
Kind of down that line. This guy decided to basically go eschew modern, you know, reality or modern amenities or what have you, and live in the woods, which he did in like a system of tents in the little stove or whatever for 20 years. He did this. Wow. And then he decided to just stop doing it. And this is a book about him. It's not a memoir. It was written by somebody named Michael Finkel, but it's a story about a different man. I forget his name. But that's what it's called. It's called the Stranger in the Woods. Is about this guy who decided to go out and live like a hermit in the woods and then return to talk about it. So I'm looking forward to that. I don't know what anything about what's behind the story. I think it started as like a article that some guy wrote, like Nature magazine or GQ or something like that. Some guy discovered this guy, and sometimes, you know, there's a well-received story and then they expand it into a book. I believe that that's what this is. It's by Michael Finkel. So that's what I'm going to read next, and over to you.
Yeah, that sounds really interesting. It's almost like a little bit of like, you know, Thoreau, Walden, but like, I think Walden was only a year long, whereas this is 20. So that's pretty wild.
Yeah. It's crazy, right?
You told me about that book and I'd never even heard of it, but that sounds really interesting. Good.
Pick. I hadn't either.
Good, yeah. Pick by our mom.
Yeah. Go mom.
But then again, you know, she was reading and thinking about books for decades before we were even, you know, a thought in her mind. So shout out to her.
This is true.
Well, you'll be, I just kind of figured this out recently. I think you'll be excited that what I'm reading next after this very challenging book called Real Presences by George Steiner. I need to swing back to fiction, and I just want to read something that's engaging and, you know, not gripping per se, but like, is a new voice that I can dip into, and, you know, one that you've highly recommended. And this is a recent gift from you, by the way. So I want to throw that in there. It's a bit of a bump up, as we like to say. So I'm going to, this is a writer that you've talked about on the show a number of times in recent episodes. So I'm going to, for the first time, I'm going to take on a book by Claire Keegan.
Nice.
It's going to be, the book you gave me is called Small Things Like These, I believe it's called. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah.
So you've been really highly recommending her both on this show and off, you know, quite a bit. So I'm very curious about that. It's a slim novel. I think it'll be the perfect thing to transition to after, like, you know, grinding the gears of my brain to like powder, you know, reading this book by George Steiner. So that's going to be next. I'm looking forward to, you know, introducing myself to Claire Keegan and kind of seeing what all the noise is about.
Well, let me make a quick comment on that before you continue.
Yeah.
Very quick. That book, John, is maybe a sign of things to come, but I'll just leave it at that. That book, as I went back and looked at this, I think in recent memory, the last 20 or 30 years, and it's a very short book, so this has something to do with it. That's the only novel I can think of that I was so impressed by that I read it twice in the space of 1 year. Wow. You know, like I read it early in the year and then I read it again. Part of the reason is that, weirdly, you'd never be able to find this, but the novel I'm writing now was partially inspired by this book in a way. It was more like the way she wrote it. I was so impressed by the writing itself. You won't find that in the book I'm writing because I'm not as good as her. But I thought about it a lot during the rest of the year while I was working on this book, so that I actually just paused and read it again. Mainly because it's very short. Like, you'll get through it in like 2 or 3 days. But wow. Obviously, I think that's a great choice. So
I didn't even know that. So that's because I know.
No, I didn't. I didn't say it.
I know that this book is your book is coming down the pike, and I'll be very interested in that. It makes even more sense to read this book first. So.
Yeah, but you won't find many connections. It's just something that, I'd say, kind of inspired me in a way. I could explain that later off the air.
Yeah. We'll get to your book in due time. Probably on this program, I'm sure, in one way or another.
Well, I'm not asking for that. You know, yeah, we'll see how it goes.
Well, I think it's just going to come up organically. But yeah, so I'm going to read that Small Things Like These by Claire Keegan. Looking forward to that. And as far as the next episode, now we'll just do this on air, but, you know, sort of an on air production meeting really quick. We talked about a couple of different ideas, but I think the one that we've talked about the most and the one that we've been circling around is an episode that will focus on our favorite female characters. Is that right? Is that what you were thinking?
That is what I was thinking, yeah.
Okay, so let's just make the call right now. At episode right. 63 will be the Book Exchange Twins will share some of their favorite female characters and why they love them so much. And I think that's going to be just one of these episodes where it's going to be really interesting to even like think about and research, you know, as you go back and like, who are some of my favorite characters that happen to be female
or right.
stand out in my reading memory. And so that could go in any number of directions. So I think that's a really interesting sure topic. I think we're going to have a lot of fun with it.
Yeah. And it's not episode 5, which was our favorite female writers. This is a different thing. So our favorite female characters, important to point that out.
Say that again, because I believe you cut out for a few seconds there and it's not quite clear what you were saying.
Oh, okay. Well, if I didn't cut out, sorry to repeat it. I'm just pointing out that it's not our episode 5, which was our favorite female writers.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
These are our favorite female characters, totally different animal, but it's worth pointing out.
Yeah. So we're not retreading old ground here. It's going to be something different for us. So that's going to be really cool. Hope everyone will join us for that. You're the host, man, for this one, so I'm going to kick it back to you to close us out.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, I would have rolled with it. But, yeah. No, I agree. I think that's going to be it's one of these topics that's like not only will the podcast be fun, but the ramp up, as you suggested, will be fun also. Because I can only think of one, you know, so not that I won't have other favorite female characters, but which are the ones that really stand out? I'm looking forward to going back and checking that, looking into that. Yeah. So, yeah, but that's going to do it for episode 62. I think it was a great discussion. Congratulations to Tess Gunty. Very discussion-worthy original novel, and she's won a lot of awards. I think she mainly earned them. So that is it for the latest episode of the Book Exchange Podcast. We appreciate y'all listening and hope you have a great rest of the weekend and holiday season.
Well said. Take it easy, everybody.
Bye-bye.